From WABE in Atlanta, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thank you for listening. This is our daily look at the arts and culture of Atlanta and the creative minds that make it happen. We have a trio of artists on today's show, each bringing a very different perspective on the Southern voice with their work. Jiha Moon juxtaposes traditional iconography from her Korean heritage with contemporary pop culture references to create colorful, humor-filled works. Pam Longobardi works mostly in plastic in response to her activism related to keeping our oceans clean. And first up, a truly monumental voice in American art, Carol Walker. All ahead on City Lights. Artist Carol Walker spent her teenage years in Atlanta after her father, artist and professor Larry Walker, got a job at Georgia State University. Her family lived in Stone Mountain, home of the famous and controversial Confederate Memorial carving. That carving, the world's largest bas-relief sculpture, inspired Kara's own monumental piece, The Jubilant Martyrs of Obsolescence and Ruin. It was recently acquired by the High Museum of Art. Even if you're not familiar with her name, you may be familiar with Carol Walker's work. She's the MacArthur-winning artist behind the enormous Sphinx made of sugar that was once housed in a Brooklyn warehouse. I recently spoke with Kara about her career, starting with the new High Museum acquisition that, like most of her work, has a very long title.
I think I have a tendency towards long titles that kind of overshoot the point a little bit, but I'm always looking for something that's more poetic than dogmatic. And in this case, I because I was concentrating on Stone Mountain or some of the ideas around Stone Mountain, I really thought that it needed to be to express a kind of enthusiasm that went into the creation of that monumental carving.
I was so shocked in reading the background about what you experienced when you moved here from California as a 13-year-old girl. I am from Chicago. I moved down here when I was an adult, but I didn't realize that sort of racism and nastiness was as overt as mm-hmm. it was in the late 60s.
It's overt. And I think, you know, what was interesting, or I don't know, it was interesting in retrospect and sort of annoying and irritating and frightening as a child, or young adult, is that, you know, my experience also dovetailed with puberty in high school and the sort of nastiness of kids at that age anyway. Mm-hmm. But then there was a sort of added layer that was quite mysterious to me in a way of the byproducts and effects of long-standing, let's call them traditions, you know, not because it feels too shorthandy to just sort of say, like, you know, people said racist things, like that's true, but also people held on to beliefs that were foreign to me. Even as a, you know, young Black woman, I really had a different sort of maybe experience or set of ideas about myself coming from a different place. And mm-hmm. so I felt very alien in this environment that seemed kind of locked in a kind of battle with past and with the present and with, you know, current realities. And so
I wonder how different it might have been if your parents had moved into the city rather than Stone Mountain. I mean, that really
I wondered that too, but it didn't happen. So I got an experience, yeah, as my mom likes to sort of spin it, you know.
And it fueled your art.
Well, I think I had art as a part of my background early on, and I think that helped me be able, you know, having art was a way of processing, you know, living a life and having experiences that I couldn't quite understand.
For people unfamiliar with your work, you use silhouettes and the Jubilant Martyrs shows about a dozen scenes. Would you please describe some of them?
Well, it is all cut from large sheets of black paper, and I began with a kind of a riff on the three horsemen who appear on Stone Mountain, carved on the side, Jefferson Davis and Robert E. Lee. They are not true or well-studied portraits or portrayals of the men on horseback, but I did find it very curious that one of the attributes of the carving on Stone Mountain is that it's sort of unfinished and the horses have no legs and they appear to be sort of disappearing or being swallowed up by the mountain or by water or some unseen force. So there's some central horse figures. There's a figure that is being hung. There are figures that have gross, stereotypical sort of Negro features, so-called, and there are figures that are meant to conjure up a kind of the ideal of the lost cause, the soldier with the broken sword, the monumental figure on top of a heap of bodies. I think one of the riffs or one of the motifs or one of the jokes that sort of recurs in the work is something about horses and mules. And so there are a couple of people in a pantomime horse suit also.
Since you've been in the public eye, there have been many conversations about your work. And one quote that gets thrown around a lot from art critics is that the work is satirical, showing the ridiculousness of wholesome depictions of the antebellum South. If that's what you would call it, if that's what you, the artist, would call it, what draws you to satire?
I mean, satire is fine as a word, but it's not exactly what I think that I'm doing. In fact, I think that I'm an accidental satirist.
Now there's the title of your autobiography.
You know, I think that as a young, young artist, in graduate school, and when I really started thinking about what was important to me, I also started thinking about the limitations that were sort of presented to me as a Black woman, American artist. And some of those limitations have been, you know, handed down from generations of oppression and neglect. And then some of it was also handed down by a generation or two of Black arts movements, you know, sort of reclaiming of the creative space for people just like me. So that in a funny way, I'm really deviating from your question. In a funny way, I felt as a painter or printmaker sort of compelled to go in and go hard on the idea of reclaiming history and also questioning that history that must be reclaimed. And somehow I had these sort of, it's almost like two competing interests from outside of me battling for primacy as the sort of like overarching conceptual conceit of my work. And then there's also me who's kind of like, I don't really want to be in this fight. So it's sort of like those are the three things that are at work. And it winds up being quite funny.
It all works.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes talking with Kara Walker. Her work, The Jubilant Martyrs of Obsolescence and Ruin, has been acquired by the High Museum of Art for the permanent collection. A Subtlety or The Marvelous Sugar Baby was your first public art piece, and it was inside the Domino sugar refining plant in New York. How did thinking about historical narratives of sugar lead to the Sugar Baby, which was enormous?
Yeah.
I mean, not just in its size, the impact.
Yeah, that was a lot of work in a short period of time. I mean, a lot of thinking work, because I was thinking about sugar, and sugar has got a history much longer than the one that we think of, and I kind of wanted to embrace all of it. I wanted to have, the idea of these sugar sculptures that were present in, the courts of medieval kings. And also, I wanted to talk about the transatlantic slave trade, and also the cultivation of sugar, and also, sugar's impact on, contemporary or modern history and contemporary society. So it kind of had to be monumental. Also, the space was huge, and I wanted to, really think about the problems of public art, which generally one of the problems that I think artists encounter and that the public encounters is a kind of disconnect between the conceptual art world, and all of its sort of theories and talkiness, then the idea that art for the public should also be pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
It should elicit wonder. And so
that's why you went with your camera trying to capture people's responses to Sugar Baby.
Yeah, I think it was fascinating also because, I make things and I want to be an artist making things, but I am also a witness to some extent. And so while that piece was up, I really wanted to be there because there was something cool in town. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of like separate from me in a weird way. Like I wasn't thinking, oh, I made this. I was thinking, God, there's this awesome thing that happened.
Well, to tell us
it's
about
such an anomaly.
The dimensions.
It was 75 feet long by about 35 feet high at its tallest point. And, it's a sphinx-like figure that's got mammy features and breasts and a butt and a vagina and sort of crouch in this odd position that's both subservient and also very majestic and upright, and it's covered with 40 tons of sugar thereabouts.
Astonishing.
So it was quite a lot of, it was a lot of effort by, like a very concentrated, amazing group of facilitators really help put that together.
How do you feel about the ephemeral aspect of art? I mean, when I think of what you put into that and the size and impact of it, I think, well, wouldn't you like generations, future generations, to experience this? No,
it's always ephemeral. I don't know. I think that, that piece in particular was really designed to live in this moment, prior to the destruction of something that I thought was, quite tragic in a way, that the forces of capitalism ruined all of these bodies and all of these lives for centuries of slavery, and then, all for naught, all for what, So, and in some tragic way, it could only live for a moment for those sort of lost souls or something. I mean, if I'm not satirizing things, I'm just a downer. So I'd be rather.
Do you still have the hand from this?
Yeah. The hand of the Sphinx, the hand that was configured into a fig sign, which is kind of a rude gesture, is currently on view in Hydra in Greece in a small art space called the Slaughterhouse, which was a former slaughterhouse. And it's a very tiny jewel box space that the hand just fits within, and it has a fresh coating of sugar.
Hmm.
It's a strange place for it to end up, but it feels very it feels very right somehow, because I did want in some way to have a relic.
And there it is, in the land of relics.
Exactly, yeah.
We spoke with your dad last year when he was awarded the Atlanta Contemporary's Nexus Award.
That's right, yeah.
Has his work inspired your own in any way?
Well, you know, my dad is an amazing educator and artist, and one of the gifts that he gave me, which I sometimes forget to appreciate and sometimes remember full on, is just the gift of valuing creativity. You know, sort of like making my own legend as I speak, because I've said this a number of times, but, you know, he put the chalk in my hands. You know, he, you know, sort of nurtured a sense of my own being and my own capacity to sort of belong to myself in a way in the making of something. So I could sit sort of for hours and draw or try and make things, or like I was always trying to make houses out of cardboard, which always fell apart. Or, you know, I was always kind of invested in that in a way that was, well, I say it was valued. It was also kind of, you know, lauded a little bit, which doesn't hurt when you're small.
No, and maybe then this offsets your memories of them moving you to Stone Mountain. Kara, do you think the public is more accepting of your work now?
To some extent, we'll see. I'm working on a show now. I think that there's more room in a broader... a collection of voices than maybe when I first started out, or even if I think about the sorts of arguments that artists of color have had to face over the last, you know, in the 20th century, there has in the past been, you know, a pretty broad array of types of responses to my work. Mm-hmm. And so while, you know, sometimes I encounter a kind of critical response that seems hellishly cruel. And I think that my work also elicits some of that, because it comes from sometimes quite dark ideas or dark realities or dark sentiments. And so sometimes my treatment, which is somewhat, you know, sometimes satirical and sometimes that satire masks a kind of fatalism, doesn't go over well.
Well, but when your heritage is slavery, I mean, mm-hmm. you know, how can you not have that right. perspective?
Well, you can have that perspective, but, you know, I think that sometimes I come off as a bit blasé or a bit slap in the face, because there is something kind of odd and cruel about, you know, art, the making of art, because it doesn't solve the problems. You know, it just sort of presents the image, or an image that's reflected from a number of different sources, or sometimes it presents a kind of internal confusion that is sort of the result of trying to process history.
Yeah, and those images and that art, it may not solve the problems, but it can lead to the conversations which are essential for finding resolutions, or at least moving toward understanding. Mm-hmm. Kara, it has really been a privilege to talk with you, and I admire your work tremendously.
Well, thank you. It was really a treat to talk to you as well.
Kara Walker's piece, The Jubilant Martyrs of Obsolescence and Ruin, was recently acquired by the High Museum of Art, where it will be on view in their permanent collection next year. After a break, conversations with artists Pam Longobardi and Jiha Moon. You are listening to City Lights here on WABE. We're back with City Lights on WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us today. Every 2 years, the Hudgens Center awards a $50,000 prize to one Georgia artist. It's one of the largest prizes of its kind in the entire country. Jiha Moon is among the four finalists. In her work, she combines traditional iconography from her Korean heritage with contemporary images like Angry Birds. I spoke with her about that juxtaposition.
I've been researching source material not only from Korean folk art and things that I really like. At the same time, I also look around the world, what's going on. And of course, I have a son who is 9 now. But when I was making work around with the Pennsylvania Dutch folk art that has a lot of like a bird influence on it, and he asked me if I could include some of his favorite thing. So that was one of the iconography was Angry Bird, and it all started out as a joke. But then I really enjoyed it. And then the thing about my work is a lot of time things are hidden, almost a camouflage in a way. So people don't see it immediately, but then they kind of find out later on and they get really fascinated. So from outside, it looked really traditional and kind of old or classic. But then kids come in, the first thing they find is Angry Bird. No matter where they are, they always find it.
It's their radar, huh?
Yeah, and I always think that that's always a good connection to connect with the younger generation to get into art. And my work also deals with humor greatly, and I really enjoy that element.
Yes, I love the whimsical touches. And you're not only combining old with new, you're also combining high culture with popular culture.
Yes, popular culture.
Do you think there are too many barriers between the two?
I think that we only see the extreme like juxtaposition often, and that's the thing we notice most. But in real life, a lot of cases, the things are really blur or gray area. People really don't notice. And I often mimic that in my work. So, of course, you go to the museum and you see the white wall and people get scared. Is it okay for us to go inside? And we are certainly not going to buy the work. But, you know, as an artist, I feel like it should be open all the time for all kinds of everybody. And I kind of feel that it's a lack of it. And as an artist, for me, to invite the cultural references and popular culture is a way to invite people, and they feel like they're invited and look at the work. So for me, combining high culture with lowbrow or popular culture is necessary.
And also another way to express the whimsy and the humor
yes.
that you value. I wondered about, there was one painting that had like a salsa.
Chiquita Banana Lady?
Is that Chiquita Banana?
Yes.
Okay.
Instead, she's holding peaches.
Okay, this is important. I know peaches are very prominent throughout your work. What is the significance of that symbol?
It's something really mysterious and novel in my Asian heritage. At the same time, it's a symbol of like me being in Atlanta, being in the Southerner. And people often ask me where I'm from, and I know exactly what kind of answer they're looking for. But, you know, this is the city I lived the longest. So I am, just as much as Korean, I'm also Southerner and Atlantan. So that peach is a symbol of that as well. So in Asian culture, peach is a symbol of longevity and then chase away the bad spirit. In Atlanta, peach is also the big symbol of South. But also people often look at it as a body part, which I don't mind. I actually find it really quite humorous and almost kind of do it slightly little more to catch that. So people think that it's a bosom or a baby bud and, you know, things like that. I really enjoy that.
Would you tell us a bit about your artistic training and how you developed your style?
Mm-hmm. I was trained as more likely realistic painter when I was in Korea. And in Korea, it's kind of funny. They have art painting department. It's two parts, one Western painting department. The other one is called Oriental painting department, which is Korean traditional art.
And they call it Oriental?
Yeah, I know it's a bad term right here, but that's what they called it there.
That's intriguing.
Yeah. So, but I was trained as an oil painter. So I graduate in Korea, both having BFA and MFA. My major was Western painting. So I've been painting oil on canvas for a long time. And then I came here, and then I went to school in University of Iowa, where I met my husband. After I have a luxurious time of having a large studio in grad school for 3 years, I realized how spoiled I was after I graduated, because the situation was different. I couldn't have a studio or anything. All I had was just one little table. So I had to switch medium. I couldn't make a large oil on canvas work. So that's the time that I look at traditional material again, and also paper as a serious material, because something dry quickly, but something you can always start fresh and new without having too much pressure, unlike white canvas. So it was eye-opening experience. And then, you know, ink and acrylic also. Acrylic is such a young medium. It's American invention, less than 100 years old, and it dries really fast. And it gives you a lot of opportunity to explore, making different surfaces and layerings. It requires different technique and time, which I really enjoyed. So it was just perfect.
It's interesting to hear you talk about how the circumstances, the physical circumstances of your studio space dictated the medium that mm-hmm. you were working in. I don't think many people who aren't artists stop to consider that. The Hudgens Prize is the largest prize money for a single artist in the entire country. What would it help you accomplish, Jiha?
First of all, I think that if I never had to apply this type of competition, it would have been better, because I think that all artists deserve to have attention and get financially supported to do what they need to do. But if I have privilege to earn that money, I'll probably continue to explore and expand my practice. Also, I'm a mother and I have a family to support, and I want to contribute that this is also possible. Artist is a real job.
Yes, and one that can require hours, months, years of work. You mentioned your little boy. Does he paint with you?
Yes, he is always drawing and painting. But what we simply do is just giving the material, and we don't really try to teach him or anything. My husband is also an artist, and so he's surrounded by us, and then being in that environment is just really awesome. And he actually is kind of bossy, and he does not listen very well. So he also, that age, he acts like he knows everything. So it's very hard to instruct, but I think the best way is to provide what he wants to use, and that all we can do.
Does he give you comments about what he thinks you might add to?
About his work?
No, to
about
your work.
About my work? Yes, he's very funny.
He's a critic, too.
It's funny that he comes to my studio and he gives me always compliment how much he likes my work. I think it's because I'm his mom, but he is very sweet.
That is so sweet. Jiha Moon, I wish you good luck with the Hudgens competition and continued good fortune throughout your career.
Thank you so much.
Jiha Moon is among the four finalists competing for the Hudgens Prize. Her work is part of a group exhibition at the Hudgens Center in Duluth, which is on view through October 21st. After a short break, artist Pam Longobardi will tell us about blending art and activism activism with her exhibit, Reworlding. I'm Lois Reitzes. Thanks for joining us for City Lights here on WABE Atlanta. This is City Lights on WABE, where ATL meets NPR. I'm Lois Reitzes. Welcome back. Pam Longobardi is not only an artist, she's an environmentalist and activist who has traveled the world exploring oceans. Lombardi is a distinguished professor of art at Georgia State University and has won numerous awards for her work. Plastic is central to her work, and she joined me in studio to talk about her exhibit, Reworlding, on view now at Hathaway Gallery. How did you become fascinated with oceans?
Well, my dad actually, I think, was central to that, as well as my mother. My dad was an ocean lifeguard, and my mother was a state swimming and diving champion in Delaware. And so they were both water people. And we spent, you know, our childhoods at the shore in Jersey, New Jersey. And I think I had some of my earliest and biggest lessons in the ocean, and also the most amazement and wonder.
Okay, what were some of those lessons? Because you could have emerged from that painting watercolor seascapes.
Well, I think, you know, there's a kind of knowledge that is evident in the consciousness of all the creatures that come from the ocean, including us. So if we think back to life on Earth starting in the seas, and we look at our connection to that, we still have the ocean inside of our bodies. Our blood is very, very similar to the composition of seawater. And so we have an innate connection to the ocean.
You know, I think that may be the title of a piece by a composer named John Luther Adams, who won the Pulitzer for music maybe 3 years ago. Is it We Are Ocean? I think that.
Oh, that sounds lovely.
Yeah, he's from Alaska.
Wow.
And when you were describing our bodies as ocean and having that within us, I never stopped to think of it that way. So then the next question is, where and when did plastic enter your work?
Well, I think I was seeking a reconnection to ocean because I was living in Atlanta for already a number of years, and I had kind of lost that connection. I was just working, you know, in my studio, building my teaching career as a professor here, and I realized something was really missing for me. And so I sought out a reconnection to a place that was really special to me, and it was the Hawaiian Islands. I had spent a lot of time there in the 90s with a friend of mine, and we used to spend the day just exploring the island and snorkeling for 8 hours a day, and I just saw extraordinary life, life force in that ocean. And so I think it was a little bit before the plastic scourge that is now evident on most of the world's beaches. And so seeking that reconnection, I went back in 2006. I found a residency that was on the very southern tip of the Big Island of Hawaii, which is the largest and southernmost of the Hawaiian Islands. And it's also the first landmass that the entire sweep of the Pacific Ocean current comes up towards. And what I found there were a mountainous, just unbelievable pile of colored plastic that was coming out of the ocean. And I was just astounded by it. I couldn't imagine that this was happening in the sea, in the ocean, and that, you know, I started to really think back on my work as an archaeologist. I worked with a homesteader who was a scientist who was studying the homestead sites of Lewis and Clark when I lived in Montana. I also worked as a paleontological illustrator for Jack Horner at the Museum of the Rockies, also in Montana. And I felt like I was looking at some kind of a site that was a collision of nature and human culture. And it just floored me. I started to feel initially that I had to start picking this up stuff up and bringing it back for people to see. But before I did any of that, I took documentary photographs. They were forensic photographs because I really did think that I had stumbled upon a crime scene.
Mm. The movie The Graduate comes to mind.
Yeah.
And Benjamin is told one word, plastics. And this one word, I mean, it's horrible in terms of what you have discovered. And how did the artist in you reconcile with this garbage that had polluted and was ruining our environment?
Well, I think it was a call, sort of a call to arms for me. It was it was a number of things. First of all, it already looked like it was installed. I think the forces of nature act incredibly upon all things, all objects, and so these plastic objects that had traveled, you know, immense distances, had at one time been in human hands or part of human daily life, and then had lost that contact, you know, with their function, were discarded, and somehow made their way, as most things do, everything sort of flows to the ocean eventually, been part of the dynamic source of energy and climate on this earth, which is ocean currents. And so they had moved, they had traveled an immense distance, creatures had bitten them, creatures were living on them. There was just this very, very complex and alarming story that was being told in these materials. So I really thought about them as these kind of haunted objects, that they were a kind of ghost of our consumption. Mm. And they were coming back to tell a message from the ocean.
It must be strange knowing all the problems that plastic causes, yet also using it as a building material for your work, because there is this contradiction between creating an aesthetically pleasing piece, which yours are, albeit with a message, while making people aware of the danger of plastics in the ocean.
Yeah, I think I really do think that the beautiful is one of my greatest weapons. I think that we have to be able to engage people first with curiosity, and second with an opportunity for a conversation. And I think the darkness of plastic, especially this ocean plastic, which has been enacted upon by just the entire natural world, when you think about it, of the ocean, it comes with a kind of presence. And I want to use that as material because it is a charged material. And I want to use it also because it prevents me from having to buy newly constructed material. I mean, the world has enough things are in it already. And I really like the fact of sort of reclaiming this, getting it out of, you know, these places where it doesn't belong, and then resituating it back in a place where it can provide a mirror to ourselves, so we can look at, you know, what we have created and perhaps not been consciously aware of its ultimate outcome. And again, these objects, they're not the same plastic that we use. This is plastic that has been transformed. So
very important point.
They are coming back as artifacts, and I think they are coming back purposefully with a message.
If you're just joining us, this is City Lights. I'm Lois Reitzes here with you and artist Pam Longobardi. Her exhibition, Reworlding, is on view at the Hathaway Gallery in Atlanta. Your exhibit, Reworlding, tells a very complex story, not only of plastics, but also refugees. First, would you describe the situation on the island of Lesbos where you traveled for this project?
Sure. Lesbos is a small island in the North Aegean. It's just, a very short distance from Turkey, a swimmable distance. And it has been the kind of landing point for, I would say, a tsunami of refugees that have been fleeing all the countries of the Middle East and also African countries. So when we hear about the refugee crisis, we tend to call it the Syrian refugee crisis, but one of the main things I learned being there and working in the camps was that there were people from a dozen different countries there, and some of them were running from, an extracted civil war that was, had blown up their houses, and other people were fleeing from drought. And if we look back to the origins of the Syrian civil war, we actually see that it started because of a drought. So all of these things really connect back to how refugees and plastic are connected, which is that at the origin of all of this, we are really seeing a story about climate change. And so to me, this wave of people coming in life vests and plastic boats was just the newest wave of plastic disaster in the ocean. And so rather than, human objects floating, they were actually people now floating on this plastic and coming across the ocean currents. And 600,000, more than 500,000, had landed on this one island.
Staggering. Absolutely staggering to think about that. And you started creating artwork from the life jackets. What did you create with the refugees?
Well, I started this project in May of 2016. On my first visit there, I was invited to show a film that I'd made about another island in Greece, Kefalonia, called Plastic Free Island, about a six-year project we'd been working on there. And the refugee crisis was in full full force at this time already in May 2016. So I sort of skipped out of a lot of the conference itself, which was a conference on small island nations and their challenges. Because I really needed to see what was happening firsthand. I feel like I needed to understand what that situation was really like. And so I was able to find a way to volunteer in a camp. And the first thing I did was work with some unaccompanied minors in a boys' camp. So these were teenagers that were between 14 and 17. And what we did, first of all, was did a beach cleanup and a kind of outing for them. These are, in every way, typical teenage boys. They were, a lot of them very bored and restless, without much to do in these camps. And these amazing aid workers, Greek aid workers, but also, the world's volunteer organizations were there, and including the ones that do this as a functioning organization like Doctors Without Borders and Save the Children. And so they had made really a remarkable situation for them in the camps. And so we worked with them. And then I also visited the cemetery of the Life Vest, which was the sort of resting spot for all of the 600,000 life vests that had landed on those shores. So the aid workers and the Greek citizens had moved them to this, it was literally the dump of a small town in the mountains. And they were just sitting there like this sort of unmarked memorial in a way. And I saw that, I took photographs of it, and I decided then that I needed to return and make something with that material because it was just sitting there sort of rotting out in the weather. And I wanted to make a flag. And I thought of the idea of making this flag and having it be a flag not for any one nation in particular, but for a new nation that does not have geographic borders. It's perhaps more of a nation of the heart. And And so, you know, I think somehow we are being tested as humans. I think as climate change increases, I think it's calling for, you know, the spirit of the people that I saw working in Lesbos, the island citizens themselves, to come forward and to help each other and to think about each other not as different and enemies, but as we're all really in this together.
I can only imagine the social stress of 600,000 plus refugees on a small island. And here you are making a connection, creating a release for some of these refugees and citizens of Lesbos. With Reworlding, the exhibition on view now at Hathaway Gallery, the cover photo is very striking. Is that the Cemetery of Life Jackets?
Yes, it is. And so in December when I was there, we went and we just salvaged several hundred of these vests. And I had brought with me two sewing machines as well. And so I went
You traveled with sewing machines?
Yes, I did.
Oh, I bet those were not easy to get through the security check.
I didn't care. but I left them there. So it was really kind of great. We were there in December, and it was a time of a lot of joy. There were, you know, people from all over the world, you know, celebrating in the way that they could in these camps, and we were part of that. And we had been able to bring gifts from some donations from some U.S. companies of reusable stainless steel water bottles and these really nice reusable bags. And we did a whole sort of gift exchange with them. And a couple of the people who had been in their former life, there was an Afghani tailor, and he hadn't been able to sew in months since he'd been there. And so he was, you know, dove right into starting to sew the flag. And the other one was a seamstress, a woman who was from Iran, and she was sewing with us as well, and the kids were helping us piece the flag together. And yeah, it was just really kind of amazing.
It sounds it. Finally, Pam, through your projects, you do so much more than create awareness. You're synthesizing scientific data. You're working with communities. You actually are cleaning plastic out of the oceans. Would art not be as satisfying for you without these other elements?
I love that question, Lois, because I think art is the most interesting in the way that it engages in the world. And I'm curious about all these different things. And I think, you know, art has a place in almost any aspect of life. And you can bring almost anything from life into artwork. And I think, you know, for me, the kind of engagement with the scientific, with the natural, with the social is the most interesting way to be an artist.
Well, you certainly make that point. Bravo for all of your work, Pam.
Thank you. And Lois, I just wanted to make one last point, which is that we're selling these beautiful bags that have been manufactured by a social enterprise on Lesbos called Lesbos Solidarity. It's the Greek citizens and refugees, and they are available through the Hathaway website. And all the proceeds from this go to support their future. And I think they're wonderful, beautifully designed, useful objects made from the life vests.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lois.
Pam Longobardi is a distinguished professor of art at Georgia State University. Her exhibit, Reworlding, is on view at Hathaway Gallery through September 16th. Thank you. You've been listening to City Lights, a celebration of the arts and the ways in which we express ourselves creatively. Catch an encore broadcast tonight at 8. Tomorrow morning at 11, we'll talk with folks from Dad's Garage about their new show, Wicket, which looks at Star Wars from a shorter, furrier perspective. City Lights is a production of WABE at Public Broadcasting Atlanta. Our producers are Aaron Wright, Gabby Watts, and Mike Johns. Our engineer is Kevin Rinker. I'm Lois Reitzes. I'd love it if you followed me on Twitter at Lois Reitzes. That's spelled LOISREITZES. Follow the station at WABE News. That's all for today's edition of City Lights. Thanks for joining us and for listening to 90.1 WABE, Atlanta's choice for NPR.